Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, coming to you every Monday morning at 9 here on KBOO Portland. And streaming everywhere on KBOO.fm. I'm your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour, Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Patricia Kullberg. On this New Year's Eve show, we'll be looking back in order to look forward. The Old Mole Variety Hour takes its name from a radical newspaper of the 1970s, which in turn was named for Karl Marx's figure for the revolution, working away underground, changing the terrain of everyday life from below. In one of his accounts of the processes of material social change, Marx writes, quote, "Men make their own history, but they do not make it as they please. They do not make it under self-selected circumstances, but under circumstances existing already, given and transmitted from the past. The tradition of all dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brains of the living." End quote. We're weighed down today by the nightmare of climate change as well as capitalism. But here on the Old Mole Variety Hour, we believe that men and women and people of all genders, we make our own history, though we do not make it just as we would please. The circumstances we encounter today and that we've inherited from the past help shape our tactics and strategies, our political actions and possibilities. But we believe that people working together can make molehills out of mountains, and we can root them down. Today's show is all about responding to climate change, understanding our past and creating our future, negotiating the despair and hope we all live with now. It's about mobilizing for the coming climate crisis and how state power has dealt with leftist mobilizations in the recent past. It's about individual and collective responses to the crises that climate change is causing and exacerbating, and it's about how music, art, solidarity, and knowing our history can help us survive the history we've made and make the future that we want. Our shows are archived on the KBOO website. You can find the posts of weekly shows in individual segments a day or two after broadcast by going to the Old Mole Variety Hour page at kboo.fm. Audio posts there generally include links to more information about segment topics, so they're worth checking out even if you don't want to listen to the segment again or send it to your friends. You could do that too. You can also follow us on Facebook or Twitter to find out when the week's show and segments are posted online. Email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com if you have questions, comments, suggestions, or interest in participating. Contact us if you're doing activism and organizing, planning events, engaging in movement that our other listeners will want to know about. We'd love to hear from you. Today, we'll hear from Joe Clement about the impacts of climate change and how to intervene, whether individually or collectively. And we will hear at the end of the hour from Desiree Helliger's in conversation with members of the Portland band Heavy Nettle about how their activism on climate change infuses their music and their lives. And for our first segment today, Bill Resnick begins a conversation with Christian Williams about policing in the era of climate change and how to ensure that cops don't support the forces of capitalist fascism in the coming conflicts. This is the first of a three-part discussion, and today focuses on the history of policing of left demonstrations. From the civil rights movement through the WTO conference in Seattle, Portland's May Day marches, and more recent events. Here's Bill Resnick and Christian Williams.
Christian Williams, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Christian Williams is a local writer and activist, has worked in efforts to democratize police. He and the rest of us have been not very successful yet, but all is not lost, although all could be lost sometime in the future. He's on the board of the journal Anarchist Studies. He's written several books, including Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America, and also life during wartime resisting counterinsurgency. So, Christian, I have this fearful vision of the future that this is, in your phrase, this is wartime, but they're just the preliminary battles to build forces for a future, much more serious and determinative battles that are likely to come, at least for one reason, because the planet is headed to a great global warming crisis, maybe 15 years from now, maybe 75 years. But at some point, ordinary folks are going to wake up that their lives are endangered, and they're going to demand action. And serious, fundamental action, a reconstruction of everything that will be necessary. And at that time, that's going to intensify a great struggle for power between an authoritarian, corporate, semi-fascist right wing on the one side and a democratic, inclusive, love-thy-neighbor left with a very different program. And in that struggle, even if the left advanced a plan that a great majority preferred, and we have to work towards that, but at that time, the police and military, they have the guns, will have solidified, could have, well, have solidified as very radical right-wingers, and they would join the other corporate types and others to declare martial law. And then in the great national emergency, they would take care of the left. What is that CIA line, Christian? When they kill people, they don't say kill them. You'd say handle them with the greatest possible prejudice. My fear is we're moving in that direction with the police and military, and we, the U.S. left, in particular the left in Portland, particularly the socialist and anarchist left, we have to rethink our strategy towards the police and military, how we stop them from moving to the radical right wing. So, Christian, let's start that conversation by examining what's happened with regard to police-left relations over the past, 20 years from before the Battle of Seattle. And particularly as to mass demonstrations, let's concentrate, in fact, on mass demonstrations and police efforts to control and disrupt them and make them appear violent and discredit us. How do you see that trajectory?
Well, to understand the present state of protest policing, you really have to go back all the way to the Civil Rights Movement. And at that period, the police strategy was something that scholars later described as escalated force. And it was really just a matter of the police ratcheting up violence to meet the level of resistance that they were encountering. That didn't necessarily mean that they were encountering violent resistance. It just meant that people were doing things that they didn't like, and they would directly employ coercion to stop that. And the nonviolent element of the civil rights movement very cannily found a way to, while remaining peaceful and in many ways presenting this very civil, respectable, dignified image of themselves, nevertheless continued to resist in a way that provoked the police to use the only tool that they had at the time, which was to violently attack them, which then demonstrated to society and the world the violence that was always in racial segregation, racial stratification. And that had a very discrediting effect both on the Jim Crow apartheid system and also on the police specifically. So, the police would attack nonviolent civil rights demonstrators with fire hoses, dogs, shotguns. And that had – it drew sympathy to the movement and discredited the police force and also discredited the racist system that they were defending. So part of the strategic genius of that from the civil rights perspective was that it meant that they didn't have to beat the police militarily. They beat them politically instead. And in fact, the one main strength that the cops had, which was their access to violence, became their political liability. So coming out of that, the police revised their strategy in terms of what scholars later called negotiated management, which was that instead of simply showing up and attacking demonstrations, they would engage in a process of negotiation to sort of facilitate the demonstrations. And in doing that, would be able to restrict it to locations and situations and types of protest that were going to be minimally disruptive for society overall. Now, what's important to realize about this strategy is that it saved the police the embarrassment of going out and clubbing people, but the ends remained ultimately the same. The point was still to suppress the effect of the demonstration. It was simply to suppress the effect by minimizing disruption. And so that's the period where you started seeing things like free speech zones and the whole permitting system and all that kind of stuff came out of this negotiated management model. Now, that model very abruptly fell apart on November 30th, 1999 at the WTO demonstrations in Seattle, where the police had prepared for a demonstration for a negotiated management kind of demonstration. They'd had talks ahead of time with union heads and head of the Sierra Club and that sort of thing about, you know, where different groups are going to be marching. And they very carefully planned parade routes so as not to disrupt the WTO ministerial meeting. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand,
unions, in fact, had their big rally scheduled for the Huskies, the Washington football team's stadium, which is about 5 miles from the site of the WTO.
Right. But then there was this direct action component to the demonstration.
Yes.
Blockaded streets, locked down in the path of where delegates needed to travel, and completely disrupted not just the WTO ministerial meeting, but really the life of the city for several days. And faced with the failed negotiations, the police reverted to something like escalated force. They just moved in and tear gassed everybody on the street, just made mass arrests, like really went far outside the bounds of constitutionality, not to mention their own procedures.
But the mass action people, in fact, won the day. I was there, actually, and basically we took over the downtown. It was, in fact, for me, it was frightening because I thought if there was any one person who decided that Nordstrom's had to go up in flames, a gas grenade could have done it, or Bank of America, or this whole multi-billion-dollar center of Seattle was completely undefended because the police couldn't get in. There were so many people.
Uh-huh.
And I was frightened. I had a young kid with me, and I made sure that I could get an escape route if somebody began a fire. Although we also were around the Marriott Hotel or one of those, and we held the WTO people out.
Uh-huh.
And it was very strong. All those linked arms, these guys just couldn't get through. It was very successful in its own way, you know, sparking.
Oh, yeah. Like, from the social movement side, it was a roaring tactical success, and it inspired a whole wave of
right.
similar demonstrations that lasted for the next couple of years. But in policing terms, it was this enormous defeat for the negotiated management model.
Enormous defeat, yes.
Then they spent several years sort of fumbling around trying to come up with some new approach. And the best current theory that I know of the approach that they settled on, produced by a couple sociologists, I mean, not the model, but the analysis of it, named Pat Gilham and John Noakes, and they refer to it as strategic incapacitation. And so on the one hand, there are elements of negotiated management. There's the superficialities of things like free speech zones and permits and that sort of thing. But what's changed is where negotiated management really had more of a two-way give and take between protest groups and police. In strategic incapacitation, the communication is really just one way. Communication is the police say these are the parameters and you will stay in them. And groups that are willing to cooperate with that get a certain more or less comfortable treatment at the hands of law enforcement. Groups that are not going to stay in that are presumed to be sort of bad actors. They're transgressive protesters as opposed to accommodating protesters. And so they get a treatment that's a lot more like escalated force. The demonstrations that occur outside of the very tightly prescripted police-established norms are just practically considered illegal gatherings from the outset.
Or, it seems to me, any large demonstrations, I think what the police do is dispersal. They don't want to allow a large crowd to form that they cannot control.
Well, I mean,
near anything important.
There are definitely large demonstrations. Like the Women's March was enormous, and it got kid glove treatment
petrified of that, though.
But know. it was a non-disruptive event,
right,
sort of
right.
by design. Like it stayed within those parameters.
Right.
Whereas, like, so it's not really the size of the gathering, and it's not even the question of legality or of violence. It's simply the question of how much the groups in question are going to adhere to the rules laid down by the cops, often unilaterally, about how the demonstration is going to happen. So it's really the putting the police in the position of deciding what is lawful, what is orderly, and then everything outside of their very narrow prescriptions gets the hammer rather than the kid gloves.
One thing they will not allow is a very large demonstration to leave them helpless in a central city if they can avoid it. Now, I think the Women's March, I think they were really frightened because they were so outnumbered and there were so many people, and they let it happen and held their breaths, and of course nothing happened, fortunately.
I don't have any inside knowledge on how frightened or not they were, but my strong guess is that they recognized that that was a accommodating kind of situation.
Right.
And that aside from the fact that there's sort of an inherent feeling of unease among police whenever there are large crowds because of just the inherent unpredictability of large groups of people, I don't think that there was anything particularly unsettling to them about that demonstration. The other two things I should mention, though, about strategic incapacitation as a model is that it relies on constructing these different types of protest groups. So there's the protesters and there's the transgressive protesters. And that happens in two ways. One is that there's a new emphasis on intelligence in advance of the demonstration to determine who the players are and to really label groups in advance of, like, you know, these are the good protesters, these are the bad protesters. And then the second is that the police engage in very public kind of propaganda campaign to signal what their expectations are regarding the different parties that they've identified in their intelligence, and to lead the public to expect that the transgressive protesters are going to be a problem, such that when the police then act against them, it is publicly interpreted as the police responding to, you know, something bad that they're doing. So that's the sort of current state of police protest. If you're just looking at what happens sort of at a particular demonstration or at a particular moment in time, it's often very confusing as to what the cops are up to. But if you keep in mind that long trajectory of how we arrived at this point, you can start to see the logic behind it.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour talking to Christian Williams, a scholar of police and police tactics, amongst many other things. Christian has been discussing the various phases of police response to mass demonstrations from the civil rights period to today, and we have now wound up with their policy of strategic incapacitation. Let me challenge a little bit, Christian. I recall after Seattle, and then came the great May Day March in the year early 2000 and May 1st, the police did not want to allow that crowd that was completely peaceful, actually, and the groups that wanted to confront police were really not developed sufficiently at that time to have any presence, really, in that march, or chose not to. But the police decided that they had to disperse that march, and that's what, following Seattle, that was, it seems to me, what the Justice Department was peddling, is you cannot allow people to demonstrate in those numbers. And it seemed to me that was really just complete naked aggression by the police trying to disperse people, which was seen by everybody on the scene and photographed, and people who were in buildings watching it happen. It really embarrassed the police. Tell us the story.
Well, on May 1st of 2000, there was a demonstration in Portland. I mean, it's not even really right to call it a demonstration. It was more of a parade. It was among the most tame and harmless and joyful as opposed to antagonistic demonstrations that I've ever seen.
Yeah, and it was a celebration of May Day. We were sort of reviving the Workers' Day. Yeah.
And it was a fairly broad coalition of labor groups and environmental groups and a few hundred people. Like, really not anything that it's even strange that 18 years later, we even remember that this happened, because it was not on its own merits. It was a fun day, but should not have been anything more than that.
It was huge,
and
though.
It was a few hundred people.
Oh, no, Chris.
A couple thousand, maybe, but in the four-digit range, not in the five-digit range.
It was not as large as the Women's March recently, but it did dominate the streets of downtown.
Well, it only dominated the streets because the police decided to just smash it, which had the effect of distributing it all over the city and making it much, much more disruptive than it would have been. And so they literally just attacked the crowd with pepper spray and beanbag guns and horses and ATVs. And I think what happened there was that the police saw the political forces that were coming together at the May Day demonstration as being more or less the same political forces that had come together a few months earlier in Seattle, and no longer trusting the negotiated management framework, reverted to something like escalated force, where their default response to political opposition was to violently suppress it. The important thing about this story is what happened later, which is that for the next year, there was some very diligent organizing and some very diligent media strategy put in place that completely discredited the story that the police were telling about the May Day demonstration, and that kept this issue of basically of whether the public had a right to protest as a live one for the entire next year. And so the excesses of police violence on May 1st proved discrediting to both that particular strategy, but also to the police force in general, and fed sympathy to the social movement, so that by 2001, though the police had spent months saying that if the demonstration organizers didn't get a permit, that the same thing was going to happen, many more people turned out in 2001 than it turned out in 2000. And in fact, the police did not attack it at all.
Even though there was no permit, there was, though, discussions among the many groups who were doing the march with the police saying, we will maintain a pretty orderly, nonviolent, but very forceful presence, but we are not going to accept your forcing us to get a permit and regulating the signage and all of the things that you're sort of demanding.
Right. The same sort of demands that Ted Wheeler recently tried to codify in his proposal for basically putting the police in charge of regulating demonstrations.
Yes, they've been trying to do that for a long time and been defeated, actually, in many ways, which is why they've continued their policy of strategic incapacitation. I look at those days sort of fondly because we really were on the offensive in many ways, and the police had to discipline themselves. At the same time, though, there were lots of developments, it seems to me, that made doing big demonstrations, not accepting police control, but still keeping them at bay so that we could do a real demonstration. But a number of things happened during the period, 2001 to today, that made that impossible. And Christian, that has to be the last words in this first part of our three-part interview on the police and how to keep them from becoming the armed force of a fascist takeover should the U.S. and planet start collapsing into a great combined economic global warming crisis, which seems likely to happen because the internationalist ruling elites reject the science and just refuse to stop. But we will be back next week Monday to discuss what happened in politics such that police could not continue their policy of negotiated management and then develop their current tactic of strategic incapacitation. So thank you, Christian Williams. We'll be back next week.
Thanks for having me on.
That was The Dicks with Hate the Police, a track I discovered through Pitchfork's 2017 article on the history of anti-fascist punk around the world in 9 songs. Before that, we heard Bill Resnick talking with Christian Williams about the history of police responses to insurgent left actions. It's the first part of a 3-part interview exploring how to keep the forces of domestic state power from completely siding with fascists as our economic and climate crises escalate. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michel. You can find the show and its segments and related links on our KBOO webpage at kboo.fm in a day or two, and we'll post to our Facebook and Twitter pages when those audio links are available. Later on today's show, we'll hear from Desiree Helligers in conversation with members of the Portland band Heavy Nettle. Next up, Joe Clement on climate change, what to expect and what to do.
Well, despite some cold snaps, we've had a number of unseasonably warm days this December. For some, it's the difference between a light and a heavy jacket. For others, it's the difference between living and freezing to death while sleeping outside. They used to call it global warming. Now they call it climate change. But warming is still a fundamental factor in the future of human life on this planet, if not all life. In October of this year, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, released a special report on the impact of global temperature averages rising by between 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius. Now, while you might not notice that change of temperature in a room, thousands of scientists from around the world agree that if we don't cap global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius and allow it to drift up to 2 degrees Celsius, which the Paris agreements allow for, we'll see ever-rising sea levels, even more extreme weather events, even longer heat waves, the desertification of forests and arable land, reductions in crop productivity, as well as more crop failures.
I'm Mr. Green Christmas. I'm Mr. Sun.
As a consequence of all this, not only are people's homes submerged along coastlines and battered by storms, but an inconsistent food supply and disappearing sources of water mean that there'll be more conflicts over basic resources.
Yeah. What is it good for?
Absolutely
nothing.
And to make matters worse, the report says that we're actually on a trajectory to see temperatures rising by something more like 3 degrees Celsius. And the report says that we have a mere 12 years, to get halfway to where we need to be as far as sequestering carbon and reducing our output. Just like global capitalism that is changing the climate change is rife with inequities. Some of these have to do with who suffers from climate change. Others have to do with who bears the responsibility for the largely economic activities that are changing the climate. Those who suffer more include the poor, the working classes, people of color, indigenous people, women and children, people with disabilities, who, according to perverse irony, contribute the least to climate change. The biggest contributors to climate change are obviously the fossil fuel industries themselves, but also the many industries that make heavy use of fossil fuels for producing and distributing things. And then, of course, there are cars and other motor vehicles, and the airlines, and the home building industry. In the last couple of weeks, you heard Bill Resnick talking with Richard Smith about China's economy and how they can't stop building. We have 6 or 7 empty homes for every person who doesn't have a home to live in. That's millions of empty homes. At this point, you might be wondering, well, where are the consumers in this picture of human-caused climate change? The problem with focusing on consumers, though, is that this tends to fetishize their role in the whole process.
And I can't be held responsible for what I don't decide, I don't decide, I don't decide. And I can't be held responsible for what I don't decide, I'm just following the guidelines politicians have supplied.
When Karl Marx talked about commodity fetishism, he's talking about the way that commodities, things that we go to the store and buy, lose all trace of the fact that they've been made somewhere by someone with some stuff. And in a similar way, when we focus on consumers, we lose sight of the fact that their choice in the matter is sometimes prescribed by larger social forces. Take the Yellow Vest movement of France. The French government proposes raising fuel taxes on most everyone. Then, the theory goes, seeing the demand for cheaper transit options, industry will improve and produce more electric vehicles. However, many French people did not think that this was a great idea. Many took to the streets, wearing the yellow vests that they are required by law to carry in their trunks. Many people have to drive far just to get to work, especially if they live outside the cities where they work. With no mass public transit alternatives to the petrol vehicles they rely on, and not to mention the obscene tax breaks given to the richest 1%, the Yellow Vests were protesting this focus on the consumer.
The IPCC report says that rapid, far-reaching, and unprecedented changes in all aspects of society are needed to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. So yeah, consumption itself is going to change. But a key aspect of what needs to change is the way in which many forms of our consumption are individualized, if not made disposable. We need more forms of communal consumption, like public mass transit or libraries. Libraries of books, libraries of tools, libraries of music, libraries of whatever kind of thing you can use and someone else can use after you. We need to shut down the fossil fuel industry, but also the many industries who use fossil fuel energy to exploit the environment and human needs. The Green New Deal sought by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez would do some of that. Eliminate fossil fuels, or to riff off Grover Norquist, make them so small they could drown them in a bathtub. Or, as Matt Huber said for Verso's blog, we do not need to tax molecules, we need to tax the rich. Insofar as it is the rich capitalists who disproportionately benefit from carbon, a carbon tax could achieve this to some extent, but carbon isn't a class enemy. It is something all of us use. While the climate movement has done a great job naming the enemy of the fossil fuel industry, the truth is climate change is actually caused by the rich capitalist class as a whole. Thus, in reality, climate change probably won't be solved by some special climate-focused tax on only one industry or sector. It must be based on taxing the rich in general. Building the kind of transformations the IPCC says are required will take a whole lot of public revenue that can only be funded through a large-scale politics of wealth distribution. End quote.
Tax the rich! Tax the rich! Close the loopholes so none of them can fudge it. Bring 'em home, bring 'em home, and eliminate the military budget.
But we should add the only way that a politics of wealth distribution will help us avert the worst catastrophes possible from climate change is if it is redistributed through new means of living. Moreover, we must make it possible for workers in destructive and extractive industries to disinvest their labor and reinvest it in other needed tasks. We need millions of people doing restoration work. We need to plant 100 million trees. We need millions of people repairing things. We need millions of people to recycle materials. We need millions of people to coordinate new kinds of resource networks. We need millions of people to farm in sustainable ways. We need to, in all of our institutions, reinvigorate and reentrench care and stewardship. But consumers paying more for gasoline, or organic fruits and vegetables, or paying a tax on sodas, aren't going to create the space for these transformations to happen. To do that, we need to create mass movements, to move governments, and to directly confront the machine. And that may be one of the most important choices that individuals can make in these times. Join organizations like unions, like KABU, like Occupy, or like the Yellow Vests, like the Sunrise Movement, youth who staged a sit-in on Nancy Pelosi's office demanding a Green New Deal. Engage in collective direct action, like Blockadia, or pickets, or highway shutdowns, or eviction defenses. We won't get the Green New Deal we need without creating pressure through social disruption and agitation and education. For the Old Mole Variety Hour in KBOO Portland, I'm Joe Clement.
You're trying to tell me capital has won at last. Anyone who's not convinced has just been shown the door. You're trying to tell me competition turns the wheels. Smart money never deals in welfare anymore. Survival of the fittest keeps the species strong. Change is always painful, but it doesn't last too long. Excuse me, friend, I think you could be wrong. When some of us are free to rise and some are free to fall, all of us are under the dictatorship of capital.
Ooh. That was Alistair Hewlett's music rounding out Joe Clement's comments on responding to climate change. And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michel. You can find the show and its segments and related links on our KBOO webpage at kboo.fm in a day or two. And you can always find the donate button at the top right of all the KBOO webpages so you can support your community radio station. Next up, Desiree Hellegers talks with members of the Portland band Heavy Nettle about how their activism on climate change infuses their music and their lives.
My guests today are the members of the Portland band Heavy Nettle, Jordana McIntyre, Tara Hopebringer, and alias Sweet Potato for our friend over here, and Adam Brockman could not be with us today, but they're in the studio talking today about their music, their activism, their artivism, and they are some of the hardest working activists in Portland. You all have been making music together for how long?
We have all been living together for about 3 years, and we've been all making music together in that time. Sweet Potato and I have been playing gigs a little bit longer than that, maybe 4 years?
4 or 5 years.
Yeah, we did some jamming together early on before we formed Heavy Nettle.
Okay, and true confessions, you all are part of an activist household. So there's a real intersection between your living, every day, you know, living and your organizing and your music. Mm-hmm. So your music has a really strong activist focus, and you've written songs about the fossil fuel fight and a number of other issues. You want to talk a little bit about some of your favorites?
One of my favorite songs that we played here is Float Fly. And this is a song that for me is about making choices about what sort of future we want to have and are willing to fight for. There's a lot of imagery from nature, and that's because I think it's really important that we reconnect with nature and connect with how human societies can coexist in ways that actually work for us. And if we choose to return to those models instead of going along with the status quo, the way that things are, the capitalist system that we live under, then we have some hope.
Yeah, and I think I actually heard you play at a house party for some activists who are up on some charges for doing something incredibly useful in terms of saving the planet.
So that was a fundraiser thrown by Portland Rising Tide, and it was for legal defense funds for two activists who were arrested locking down in front of a train, an oil train, in Vancouver, and that happened a year ago. I actually was also arrested at that event, but I was not locked down, so I was just fined and released. I think we also do a lot of forest defense work, and specifically have volunteered a lot with BARC.
And forest defense work is climate defense as well.
Yes, forest defense and working against the, everything related to fossil fuel, infrastructure, exploitation.
Yeah, the timber industry is actually the biggest releaser of greenhouse gases in Oregon.
So you all have really put your lives on the line around this issue. I mean, it sounds like you really feel like you're fighting for the future of the planet.
And also just selfishly our own future, too. Because we're all millennials. If we don't do things now, we have allegedly 5 or 10 years, we might be too late already, but we have to totally change the system. We can't do things like carbon taxes. We can't have big green nonprofits like Oregon Environmental Council or Renew Oregon who are selling us out to corporations for false solutions. We need to totally end the capitalist system and make sure that the workers own the means of production. And if we don't do that as soon as we can, then we're not going to have much of a future on this planet, even our generation.
And I know that you've also been really involved in, or I know, Tara, at least, that you've really been actively involved in Occupy ICE over the summer.
Yes, Jordana as well, another of our housemates.
I personally worked with a medic collective, Portland Action Medics, and that's the kind of work that I primarily did there, so supporting people who lived at the camp and came through, often like after they were pepper sprayed by police or hit with a rubber bullet. Yeah, that was a big piece of our summer for us.
And have you written any songs about that issue at all?
They're in the works.
Are you making connections between and trying to shut down ICE and abolish ICE and climate change?
I mean, it's all part of the same system. It's all like othering, keeping us down and keeping us separated.
We all believe that migration is a human right, and these political borders are
arbitrary.
Not relevant when you look at the long, long ancient history of human and animal migration, and those are the patterns that we should be respecting. Not to mention the human rights of all of the refugees who are coming to ask for asylum. We have an obligation to let them in and to give them an opportunity and a safe home.
Talking with members of the Portland band Heavy Nettle, and we're going to listen to their song Float Fly.
Somebody asked me if my poison would infect the whole earth and creep back again, or if I'd learned how to regrow arms like a starfish in seaside pools. What if the wolf cried? Would I answer? Would I raise up a fence or run through the woods searching for home, filling my lungs with the sweet air from the mountainside? Sing, swim, or float, fly, hope, dream, or submit and die. I don't want to know how the story ends. I don't want to see it all then. And when the ground shakes and the trees fall, will I dig through the wreck for you, pushing through sidewalks or run? Take what I can, hiding and hoarding my privileges. Would I ignore you and forget you as I sink in the fog of a shallow life? Or would I reach out sending love signals like pathways of mushroom spores? Sing, swim, or float, fly, hope, dream, or submit. I don't want to know how this story ends. I don't want to see it all end.
Really, it's a really haunting song. Do you want to talk a little bit about it?
Well, all of us have written different songs, and basically the process is whoever has written the song brings it somewhat fully formed to the group and kind of teaches the chord progression or whatever, or maybe has some specific requests about instrumentation. Mm-hmm. And then we just kind of jam and play around and see what we like and try out different arrangements and solos. Mm-hmm. Yes, but I wrote the lyrics and the melody of that song. And in the recording, I'm doing a couple of different harmonies and playing the piano.
Yeah, I mean, there's a very intense interplay in that song between hope and despair.
Yeah.
that's the world we live in.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think that those things are mutually exclusive. For me, hope is not optimism, and hope is not even like the belief that we're going to survive all of this. But hope is knowing that there is something that I can do, there are choices that I can make, and lives that I can affect, and I have some power to change the direction of the world, even in a small way, even in the lives of the people that I have relationships with. So that for me is hope. And it's a very meaningful word for me. And I think a lot of people disdain it as being like two rose-colored glasses. But I think that it is important to have something that we can hook onto that can carry us forward, something that's sustaining, inspiring, something that we can celebrate when we have those small victories.
I think it's the rose-colored glasses when we're celebrating without recognizing the turmoil that's at play, you know, and I think holding both is that hope. I think it's really valuable.
Yeah, I don't think any of us are part of the camp of if you just think positive, everything's going to go well sort of thing. It's, you need to be cynical and judgmental of the world around you, but also recognize that we all have stuff that we're working on.
Yeah, what is the lyric, resist or die?
Submit.
Submit
or die.
Submit or die.
Submit and die.
Submit and
hope,
die.
Comma, dream, or submit and die.
Yeah, it pretty much lays it out there, right?
I think we're going to die either way.
That's right.
At what rate and in what way?
Yeah. But yeah,
submission is a death before death.
Agreed.
Wow.
I would say we're pretty anti-apathy over here.
Yeah, I'm kind of getting that. Yeah, but I don't want to see how this story ends. I feel like that is such a haunting line, right? Because how many people are actually allowing ourselves to imagine how the story ends?
I think I am, and I know a lot of people do, but we can also imagine something better as well.
But do you feel like being able to imagine that worst case scenario is actually pushing you along?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think we need to look at sort of like the myriad of ways this could play out and like let that be the fire that fuels our actions.
And I think it is very important and useful to look at the realities of human extinction and to look at the realities of all of the different potential trajectories that we're on, all of which have a lot of horrifying and devastating consequences. And those devastations are already happening. Let's be real.
Mm-hmm.
But also, like, there are a lot of other reasons and inspirations for making changes to the way that we live in our society. We know that we have better models for how we can live, and it will make our lives better to transition to those models of mutual aid, taking care of our neighbors, of having strong local communities, of being able to supply each other's needs so that we're not relying on the state for everything. These are all things that are small scale but tangible. And they're things that are going to make our lives better and give more meaning to our lives.
I think something that has led me, especially in the last 6 months, to realize that I do want to focus on using music and performance art as a medium to promote change is, if this is it, like, if we have no hope at this point, then I at least want to kind of go out in a flash of, like, beautiful, you know, creation. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the amazing acts of humanity that we see all around, even in the midst of all this turmoil and pain and all this, like, beautiful acts of resistance, all of this beautiful music and art, if humanity is going to go extinct, or at least everybody but the rich people, then, like, let's make it, like, amazing and beautiful and, like, really show that we are a force to be reckoned with and we can make something just amazingly beautiful.
There's a parable that I really like about living on this planet in trying times, which is to spend half of your time working to make it better and the other half of the time actually enjoying it. So I think about, you know, like forest activism in that way. I spend half my time sending comments and ground truthing with bark, and the other half the time I'm just in the forest actually appreciating what is, because nothing truly lasts forever. And I think music is kind of this, like, beautiful middle piece where it's cathartic in and of itself, but it's still part of the work because it's shareable.
It seems like that song in particular really hones in on the resilience of nature and really taking hope from the resilience of nature.
Mm-hmm. That's where we all come from. That's our home before all these buildings, before everything else. I mean, that's our food, that's our water.
Yeah, I mean, so what's the role of music for you all in recharging? Because, you know, having been to your house, I know that your living room is filled with musical instruments. I mean, you all look like, you know, the Partridge Family on steroids.
Sorry, we both.
But also punk.
Your very punk version of
the punk
Partridge
Family.
Yeah.
Partridge Family.
The Partridge.
So is this an important way for you all to recharge?
Music is many, many things for me. It's definitely a way that I express spirituality, and it is something that's meditative and a way to express all sorts of different emotions.
I think a big part of the work we're doing is trying to pull people back into what the real fights are, which is not against each other so much, but against the system. And I think that music is such a great avenue for that, because it's something that we all, like, innately resonate with.
impossible. Oh, yeah. It really is impossible for us to understand how big and impactful climate change would be, because we as a human race have never experienced that. We don't actually have that in our memory or an experience at all. And so it's really almost impossible, I think, for us to totally get what's happening to the degree that we're able to make changes, which is why I think, like, we need to access a deeper level. Like you were saying, music can, I think, access that deeper level, and it has a lot of very unifying effects. It speaks to our emotions. It's something that can get stuck in our head. It can become our mantra. And it's a way of experiencing joy. I mean, not all songs are joyful. I think it's a way to look honestly at climate change and at the future and at our present myriad problems and find some strength to continue and to not deny.
It's actually like a request for people to step into solidarity by simply like getting into the lyrics and singing with us. And I love that some of the songs that Heavy Nettle that we do are, they don't require instruments, and we can take them to the streets and treat them like protest chants, because then people really do get involved.
Okay, Taryn, I just want to mention that I know that you just were in a play at the Milagro.
Yes, it did. It ended in November. It was at Milagro Theater, and the play was Alebrijes by Georgina Escobar.
Okay, and you have another play coming up in the Fertile Ground that you're directing.
That's right. I am directing a play called Creating Life on the Inside, and it's through the Rogue Pack Theater, and we are currently facilitating a class at the Donald E. Long Detention Center with some of the kids who are regrettably locked up there. And we are taking some of the scripts that they've created over the last few terms, and we're going to be working on it. I'm going to be working on it because I'm directing the show with some professional actors, and we're doing the show for the Fertile Ground Festival. And that will be January 25th, 26th. February 1st and 2nd at the Selwood Play. If you want to contact us or book us for a gig, you could email us at
heavynettlemusic@gmail.com.
You've been listening to an interview with the Portland band Heavy Nettle. We're going to go out with their song Dangerous Together. That one is by Sweet Potato. This has been Desiree Helligers with the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Black scarf over my face. No time to wait for the state. Oh, shish. I think I just got mazed. It's where we find some peace, agency and a break from anxiety, and maybe even dream of unity. Safe with each other, dangerous together. Safe with each other, dangerous together. Go! And when all of our fears awaken, we don't know if we're gonna make it. At least our love rings true. Not the brand that trumps hate, but what crunches fists and traces fingertips and hopes to find a soul too soon.
That was music of the band Heavy Nettle. And before that, we heard their conversation with Desiree Helligers. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM in town, and streaming everywhere at kboo.fm, where you can also go today to make your end-of-year contribution to your community radio station. I'm Fran Michelle. I've been your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks very much to Patricia Kullberg for engineering and to John Nilsson for editing. Thanks to Bill Resnick and Christian Williams for their conversation on policing. Part two of that interview will be broadcast next Monday at 9 a.m. on the Old Mole. Thanks to Joe Clement, Desiree Helligers, and the members of the Portland band Heavy Nettle. Thanks to everyone working to reduce global warming and police violence and to save forests and the commons. Thanks to you who are KBOO members for making this radio station possible. Thanks to 2018 for being almost over. You can find the audio of this show and helpful links on our KBOO webpage in a day or two. We'll be back next week, next year, with more from The Mole. Until next week, keep digging.